The Geek Cave, brought to you by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. Gamefly, video games delivered. And GameStop, power to the players. Hey nerds, we understand you. Drop those controllers, lose the wizard hat, and ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, oh searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Now, broadcasting from a top secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Kent Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
And welcome to the Geek Cave Podcast movie segment. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
I'm Chad, and welcome to that movie segment where we discover who bludgeoned Darren with his own microphone. We are brought to you by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today, GameStop, power to the player, and Gamefly, welcome, video games delivered. Endgame is coming back to theaters. It's got more scenes this time.
Yay.
To make more money and more sore butts.
Yay.
If it makes that extra 70 million, does it overtake Avatar? Or is now it's a new movie, so it needs to make like $2.5 billion again? Because I don't know that I want to sit through it again in the theater. It's good. I liked it. But, you know, that's a lot of time. Anyway, Gears of War movie is coming, and they're settling it in an alternate dimension. The relevant quote from the article was, "In order for the movie to be successful, it has to be a great movie first and a Gears movie second." That was Coalition studio head Rod Ferguson. Well, it was me quoting him. Claiming that by setting the movie away from the continuity of the games and comics, it can stand on its own and hopefully succeed. More power to you, Rod. I hope that you're correct. There is a new Hunger Games book coming that's going to take place 64 years before the first book. It's not out yet. The book isn't, but Lionsgate's already decided they're going to make it into a movie.
Of course.
They made the other four.
Yeah.
From the three books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's like, you know, New Line made the three Hobbit movies out of the one.
That's true there. So Bruce, the shark from Jaws.
Friends, not food.
Yep. Is getting restored and donated to the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures. You know, this 45-year-old model. It's the fourth and last model to be cast. You know, for the 1975 summer blockbuster. And according to reports, it just needs eyes and teeth now, which will probably make it look less scary than imagining that giant shark without eyes and teeth. Just Grandpa Shark do. Michael Fassbender, coming off of a lot of really poor movies, Snowman, Assassin's Creed, Dark Phoenix, Kung Fury, will be taking on the role of Malko Linga, an Austrian nobleman and freelance CIA operative. It's a book character. There's like 200 of these books following Malko. All right. And the hook is that this guy, he was put into a concentration camp during World War II that was specifically there to keep spies. And so this guy learned from this, you know, these, I would say greatest, but they all got caught. So, but a huge number of spies that are all together in this prison camp. And if you were really hoping that Michael Fassbender was going to be James Bond and were disappointed, well, here he is being a secret agent spy type fella. But I mentioned Dark Phoenix, which means Darren, you want to talk to us about Dark Phoenix?
Yeah. Yeah. To be fair, I haven't seen it in theaters yet, and I'm one who I've enjoyed the first class films.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed most of the original X-Men films, except for X3. And the Dark Phoenix saga is one of my favorite X-Men storylines. So how the hell do you keep fucking it up, Hollywood? So,
do you really want us to answer that?
No, it was rhetorical. Okay, so, you know,
that
some
means we don't have to answer, right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah. The summer blockbuster
I don't
season,
have anything anyway.
It, you know, the poor Sophie Turner and everyone else. The summer blockbuster season, as you know, is really competitive, and if you don't start off strong, you're going to be left in the dust. Dark Phoenix didn't start off all that great. I believe that their opening night take was about $5 million
mm-hmm.
nationwide. So
that's
yeah,
not great. That's on a multi-million dollar budget.
That's sad backwards, which is das, which is das not good. And the Dark Phoenix. Go ahead.
I think I know who's going to bludgeon you.
So we're taping this on June 22nd. Dark Phoenix had been out for about 3 weeks at this point, and it's losing 1,600 theaters already.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Exhibitor Relations Company, they kind of keep track of like films that are in the box office. They tweeted it out. Dark Phoenix losing 1,667 theaters. That's 44% of the theaters they were playing in after just being out for 3 weeks.
Woo.
And director Simon Kinberg is actively taking credit for the fact that the film is doing poorly. He says, look, it's my fault. The story's not resonating. It had the lowest opening weekend number in X-Men franchise history at just $32 million for the weekend. And 3 weeks later, it's only made another $23 million. So, unfortunately, it's just not really doing well for them. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, coming down the pike and also already out, stuff like Toy Story 4, Child's Play, Spider-Man Far From Home coming soon, shortly after this episode goes up. And then The Lion King as well. So I guess it was written on the wall that Dark Phoenix was going to struggle. And it didn't go well for them, unfortunately. Which, again, I was looking forward to it. I'll probably still see it whenever I get a chance. If it's not in my local theater in the next couple of weeks, I guess I'll pick it up on home release or at least rent it. Because I like the first class cast. And I don't like leaving things unfinished, which is why I ended up seeing X3 after hearing it was bad. So
We all have things we're ashamed of. Confession's good for the soul.
Oh, I'm not ashamed of that. Now, Superman 4, I am. But go back and find the April Fool's review for Quest for a Fuck to Give. I'm sure you'll appreciate it. I only have one other bit of news. So Batman,
mm-hmm.
freaking Batman, is getting a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
It's about time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, okay.
Are you going to travel out there with him?
No. No, man, I mean, this episode is chock full of Easter eggs, by the way.
If you don't get that last one, it's okay.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
it's not.
It's fine. No. But Batman will be the first superhero on the Walk of Fame. That's right. Superman doesn't have a star yet.
Well, that makes sense because clearly Batman is the best and been around longer than all other superheroes.
Yeah, this is Batman's 80th anniversary. Superman's 80th was last year.
You're breaking up, Darren. I can't hear you. What?
I'm driving through a tunnel.
What?
Yeah, okay.
Forgot to put the transponder into the cave.
Batman will join fellow fictional characters like Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse, The Simpsons, The Muppets, and Shrek. Who knew Shrek had a star on the Walk of Fame?
Before Batman.
Before Superman, there was Shrek. And Batman in the year 2020
Donkey.
Will also... The same class of celebrities... Batman, Julia Roberts, and Spike Lee.
And yet Carrie Fisher still doesn't have one.
Yeah.
So, a positive note, new Looney Tunes shorts are starting to show up online.
Yay.
Mm-hmm.
We've got one at dkpodcast.com. Looks like it was drawn in the 40s, but actually made today. I mean, the art style is very old school, especially with Bugs Bunny's look. But it was fun. It's really good. I suggest you watch it.
I will look them up. So, the seventh Paranormal Activity movie is currently in development. In other news, guys, did you know that there are six other Paranormal Activities movies?
Nope.
I knew there was one.
We've somehow completely failed to watch and or acknowledge them as existing until now.
And I'm okay continuing doing that.
Huh, neat.
Good for them.
We'll have to get Carly and the Crypt Kicker to review those.
Excellent.
Because it means we don't have to.
Yep.
Good Omens was finally released as a miniseries last month on Amazon Prime. And Justin and I for sure will get in some details because I doubt that Darren had a chance to watch it. But honestly, I think that even though it's on Prime and will be available to me as long as I have that, I think I'm going to buy it on Blu-ray anyway.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So now, on to the review and discussion property. Good Omens is based on the book of the same name by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett and is an eschatological comedy wherein the Antichrist is born to the wrong family, ends up to an angel and a demon to address things. The novel is absurdist. It's funny. The miniseries maintains that in glorious fashion. Michael Sheen and David Tennant play their roles as Aziraphel and Crowley with panache. I think panache is the only word that really works here.
Absolutely.
Panache. And it's glorious to see. So if I were to compare this to anything else, I would say Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In terms of the style of humor and the people that it's really going to reach out to.
It's absurd yet poignant. It's just this weird conglomeration of plots and characters. It's irreverent. It's hysterical. It's just a great book. Now, there are some people who don't like Terry Pratchett's style of writing, and I'm sure there's some people who don't like Neil Gaiman's style of writing.
But call those people wrong.
But for me personally, when reading the book, I couldn't tell where Terry Pratchett ended and Neil Gaiman began and vice versa.
Mm.
It was so well crafted. And the one thing you have to remember about this book is this was written back in the day before the internet was really a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they wrote this together, but separately.
Mm-hmm.
Like Neil would write a section and then, you know,
mail it.
Email, but in its earliest, most clunky form to Terry, and Terry would tweak it and add to it and then email it back, you know, back when floppy disks were still a thing. That's what we're talking about here. And so it was just this wonderful collaboration that resulted in this beautiful little thing into the world.
Mm-hmm. And before Terry Pratchett died, he made Neil Gaiman promise that he would get a screenplay done and get it on TV.
Yes.
Now, thanks to Amazon Prime and BBC, it's happened.
And Neil Gaiman not only wrote the screenplay for it, but was also the showrunner for it. He felt that strongly about it and his commitment to Terry Pratchett to make this happen.
And
so rest assured, this wasn't just handed off to people and say, okay, turn the book into a thing. It was handled with loving care by one of its creators from start to finish.
And the tone really seems to convey that.
Yes.
Even when it's at its serious, most serious, there's still that playfulness to it.
Mm-hmm.
That you watch this, you know that everything's going to turn out okay. This isn't one of those gritty reboot, you know, end of the world comedies where you're just like, how's this going to end? Are these characters that we like really, you know, are they going to bite the dust? No. This is a happy ending comedy kind of thing. And it is funny throughout. The weakest episode is episode 5 of 6. And it's still important and it's still funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it had to get things in place for the final episode. And anytime you have to get things in place for something else, you know, I'm looking at you, Iron Man 2, Thor 2. Infinity War.
It's amazing. I enjoyed the hell out of it and the heaven out of it.
Mm. There's expansion for some of the characters, i.e. Mm-hmm. Gabriel, John Hamm as Gabriel.
Yeah.
For those of you who are blues fans, you should know who John Hamm is. He's St. Louis native, and he was there at the Stanley Cup parades and celebrations.
Big fan of the St. Louis Blues.
So, not that anybody on this podcast is a fan of the Stanley Cup winners of 2019.
We certainly don't care about a franchise that's been in existence for 53 years and this is their first cup.
I know.
No.
People were so excited about that, too.
It's been 49 years since they last went to the Cups. You know, certainly some of us here don't really follow them or care about that.
No, who cares that they beat their arch rivals?
And yet there are some of us that care very deeply and are so happy for them.
Oh, my God, yes.
And, you know, of course, now all they've got to go is down.
Don't you have a review to get to?
I do. Michael Sheen and David Tennant play the hell out of their roles. Otherwise, there's a lot of newcomers to it. Neil Gaiman does have a cameo in there in episode 4.
As does Terry Pratchett's hat and scarf, since he's no longer with us. It's hanging on a... In the bookstore on a coat mm-hmm. rack right as Arafel walks
thought it,
in.
Thought it looked familiar, but I was like, there's a lot of things that sometimes just kind of over my head.
There are a couple of little nods to Terry specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to give anything away, but yeah, there are a few... Mm-hmm. Subtle nods to Terry Pratchett since he is no longer with us.
So if you haven't already, go make sure you watch it. It is well worth our time to watch it.
Oh, yes.
And so we think it probably will be well worth your time. Going the other realm, so we went from comedy, now let's go to tragedy. Jessica Jones season 3 released on June 14th on Netflix. And it's maintaining its reputation as the hardest of the Netflix Marvel shows to watch. It is an absolutely brutal and uncompromising show. And it is about post-traumatic stress. It's about alcoholism. It's about political power positioning. And it's a little bit about heroics.
a dash.
This season's featuring Jessica Jones, as one would expect, and Trish Walker adopting her Hellcat moniker. Which we saw that really starting to take place in season 2, but season 2 was so wibbly wobbly, but not timey wimey, that we didn't notice until the very end what was really happening there.
If you would like to learn more about Trish Walker and Hellcat, revisit I think my third long box.
Mm. And then our newest villain, who is Gregory Salinger, who comics fans would know as Fool Killer.
Yep.
And we might get a long box on that at some point.
Yeah, it's on my list.
So, season 3 is the last of the Marvel Netflix series, which meant that it had the responsibility of wrapping up its own show, but also Iron Fist and Luke Cage. Punisher was able to wrap itself. And of course, Daredevil was able to do that for itself as well. But it does it nicely. And it leaves us with just this barely hopeful ending. After a surprise cameo from Kilgrave. So, for those of you who are Tennant fans, there's a little callback in there. So, if season 1 was amazing and is probably still the strongest, and season 2 was an odd duck due to pacing and lack of a compelling villain, season 3 rectifies it and gives us a good, strong ending to the show. That still somehow leaves room for Disney to open the show up again on one of their other streaming options. BTW, the second episode of season 3 has Trish trying on a bunch of costumes, and I found it hilarious.
Okay.
So there is that. Going back to Good Omens, and just because it's funny... So Good Omens is about the end of the world. It's about heaven and hell, God and the devil, you know, angels and demons and so forth. And so there is a subset of religious-minded people who are very concerned about how these these particular things are presented. And so there was what's it called when you sign the...
A petition.
Petition, thank you. There's a petition for Netflix to stop showing Good Omens, which was funny because it's an Amazon Prime property. Amazon Prime responded and said, Netflix will cancel Stranger Things if you'll get rid of Good Omens. And I would just like to say that as a person who appreciates a good comedy, that was funny to me.
It was hilarious.
Yeah.
So
it's nice to see them getting along for a change.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Are there any other bits of news or reviews before I go after my random movie review?
I don't have anything.
Narp.
All right, then, Monsieur Harris.
And now, it's time for Chad Savage's Random Movie Review.
So if horror movies were a thing in this way, as the Vivitch, when I was in high school, I would never have become a fan of horror movies. Horror movies when I was growing up were Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. They were slasher movies. They were child's play. Yep. You know, they're Halloween. I didn't actually watch my first horror movie, The Exorcist, until I was like 17, 18 years old. All right. One that utilized tone and atmosphere and mood and just a little bit of supernatural or just a little bit of, you know, the jumps to kind of convey this terror. And so if my first scary movie at, you know, 14, 15, 16 years was The Vivitch, which I'm going to stop doing because it's hard to say, was The Witch, I probably would never have watched another one. But as an adult, as a grown-ass man, this is exactly the kind of horror movie that I love. And I'm about to spoil the hell out of this movie. So if you want to see it, and I encourage you to, skip the recap, you know, go watch it, and then come back. There's also going to be some religious terminology through it, and I'll look to Justin. If he's giving me little question mark eyes, I'll explain what's going on there. So in the 1630s, William is the patriarch of this family, and he's facing a tribunal at a church trial. Because he refuses to back down from his criticism of their interpretation of scripture, whatever that is. We don't actually know what he said or what he's done. It just shows up, you know, that's how it begins. And the movie is just super Calvinist. What that means is that they follow Calvin and John Calvin and some of the things that he believed in, which will follow through a lot. But because of his refusal to fall in line with the church and the settlement, William chooses banishment for himself, his wife, and his children. And so they go from this church tribunal. The next thing we see is the gates closing behind them as they ride out into the new world. And they settle in some wood near some woods about a day's ride away, and they build their farm. So we get this time jump, and it's about the harvest. Things are not going that well. And there's nothing particularly ominous about this, except there's no color in the world. It's not black and white. Like, it's not a sepia-toned movie, but it's like somebody filmed this and then turned down the color on the camera until it's just barely there. And of course the soundtrack, which is the most discordant, creepy thing. Fun fact, it prevented one of our members from being able to read during the movie because it was so distracting and unsettling.
Yes, my spouse has an uncanny ability to, if she puts a book in her hand, she can drown out almost anything.
Well, it was anything before last night.
Yeah, I say almost because now we found the one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that if I want my wife to leave the room, I just start playing the soundtrack to The Witch. And she will just quietly close her book and get up and go in the other room.
So,
I will only use this power for good.
So it's all standard setup stuff. Here's the family. Here's why they're out there in the middle of nowhere. And we know that something's a little bit kooky about it. And we open with the eldest daughter. She's praying confession. One of the hallmarks of kind of this Calvinist thing is this notion of broken humanity, that we are sinful completely through and through. There are lots of different ways of interpreting it, but that one's the most prevalent. This notion that we are butt dust, and to butt dust we shall return, kind of thing. And that salvation then can only come about through God's grace. And we're going to get into that in just a second. After she prays, she goes out and she's basically given the baby to go play with while mom's working. And between Peek and Boo, the baby disappears. Which we then cut to a scene in the woods where the implication is the baby's killed and turned into some goo so a witch can fly. Whether that's real or whether that's a hallucination or a dream sequence, we're not sure at this point. It's part of what makes it so unsettling is that at that point it's like, I don't know what I'm seeing. Is this something crazy and creepy for its own sake or not? Now, the mother is understandably distressed, and she blames the oldest daughter. She was the one who was in charge when the baby disappeared. The next in line, the son goes hunting with his dad, and here we get that next piece that kind of fills us in about their religious faith, which their faith is the through line of what's going on here. Basically, their religion, the way they understand the world and God, is it's necessary for this movie. Without that, then it's just a bunch of people going crazy. But the son is, and he's expressing sadness because in their faith, the baby's unbaptized. We're all born with sin. And so for him, his baby brother's in hell. And as they're traveling, he's reciting from a catechism, which is basically an instruction manual of the faith. This idea of like, okay, what are we? We are sinful beings. How are we saved? We are saved through Jesus Christ by faith and grace and so on, kind of thing. And this Calvinist kind of and a very peculiar brand of Calvinism emphasizes this human brokenness and complete reliance on God for salvation. And it should bear noting at this point that one of the themes of this particular strange is this doctrine of predestination, which is a belief that salvation or damnation has already been decided, and there's nothing we mere mortals can do except trust God. Caleb, knowing all this and knowing that he himself is not yet baptized, is terrified. He's absolutely terrified because he's also starting to notice that his older sister's going through puberty, and he's a guy. And he's just, now he's starting to think that because he's giving in to his baser instincts, as in he's noticing that he is also destined for damnation. It's super, super heavy. I mean, it's just this oppressive tone. So since the woods are supposed to be off limits and they're hunting instead of farming, mom is not pleased when they get back. And the oldest daughter somehow takes the blame. We don't know why, but she does. Even though she wasn't involved in the least little bit. So she's sent to the stream to do laundry and gather water. And the youngest child at this point now, since the baby's gone, accuses her of being a witch, spiriting the baby away for her spells. And the oldest daughter, whose name is Thomason, she plays along. But she plays along without a smile. So when she says, oh yeah, I'm a witch, and I've spirited away, she does it this straight way, which as a small child, like a 4 or 5 year old, you'd be like, oh crap, Oh, my sister, I accused her of being a witch. She really is. This wasn't a game. Oh, no. Oh, this is bad. But she was just playing. Or at least she says she's just playing. Again, we don't know at this point. But she's starting to... she's playing along basically to terrify that sibling into leaving her alone. If I had thought to do that when I was growing up, I probably would have. Yep, I'm a witch. Boogity, boogity, boogity. But it will backfire after a little bit. So that night, the parents talk of bringing Thomas into another family, basically an indentured servitude. It would be one less mouth to feed for them, but it would also get this person that they're really cold to out of the house, and that really seems to bear the brunt of the problems. So the son, Caleb, he hears this and he decides, well, he's going to go do the trapping and the hunting in order to keep his sister at home. You know, if we've got enough food, then she can stay. And in the woods, the two become separated. Caleb seduced by a young woman. Thomason's thrown from her horse, and she blacks out. And when she wakes, Caleb's gone. The family's distraught. And Thomason, you're a witch, are starting to become more pronounced. Caleb makes it back home, but he's naked. He's sick. He's terrified. And the twins just keep accusing Thomason of being a witch. The twins are the two youngest children now. Enough so... They're insistent enough that the mom and dad also start believing it. So Caleb goes into kind of a religious fit, praying and shaking like he's having a seizure, and then dies with a smile on his face. And we get this sense or this impression that whatever evil may have been in him was purged, and he dies having entered into the joy of the Lord. It's just kind of this... It's this weird moment, and I can't describe it without really spoiling what's going on there. But I would say that moment, on this moment, hinges the rest of the movie. You know, before this moment, all of the witch stuff could just be hallucinations, it could be dreams, it could be, you know, weirdness. After this moment, we know that there's something supernatural going on. You know, at this moment, we go from, oh, they're religious people, to, oh shit, religious things are actually happening to them involving devils and such. When Caleb dies, Thomason, she runs away. Her father goes after her, and he starts to comfort her, but then accuses her of being a witch. In return, she accuses the twins, because that's how you get out from being called a witch, is you say that, no, somebody else is actually the witch. And the twins, they're clearly the witch, because they've been talking to, playing with, and singing songs about one of the goats, Black Philip, and the devil will come to us in the form of a he-goat. And so the father, because he's a logical man, takes all three children and locks them in the barn with the goat.
As you do.
When he awakens the next morning, and I'm going to fly through this last, you know, half hour or so. When he awakens the next morning, the barn's destroyed. The only one there is Thomason, and before he can do anything, he's killed by the goat. The mother comes out, sees everything, accuses Thomason, and tries to kill her. Thomason, in desperation, kills her mother in self-defense, and then retreats to the house where she sleeps through the day, basically. And when she wakes up, she goes out to the barn and talks to Black Philip, who then guides her in signing her book, and we find out that Black Philip actually was the devil in this particular... in iteration, and she goes out into the woods to join a coven of witches. The movie ends then with Thomason kind of smiling and rising up into the air. There's a lot to unpack. And I'd love to talk for the next hour dissecting everything, but I'm just going to cover two things. The first is the religious aspect. Like I said, you cannot divorce the two from this movie. And it is probably one of the most realistic incarnations of Puritan faith in practice in film. I haven't seen it. Most of them you see, it's people playing at being Puritans. This one actually feels like, oh, they all converted. but the family is also, they're outwardly pious, but over the movie, we notice where they're not. The father is a proud liar. You know, he's unwilling to own his decisions until it's too late. The mother is, you know, she's always cold toward the eldest daughter, almost envious of Thomason, you know, Thomason's age or Thomason's beauty or the fact that she's just now, you know, entering puberty kind of thing. Caleb is probably the most sympathetic character. And even he, you know, he wrestles with lust because puberty's a bitch, you know. The twins are alternately cruel and lazy, depending, because the one twin, we hardly ever see or hear anything of him. It's like he's there just to be there.
Yeah.
And Thomason, even though the show is centered behind her, she yearns for the comforts of her life in England. You know, she's got this this sense almost like if we were doing a Seven Deadly Sins kind of read on her, then she's greed or gluttony. You know, she wants these comfortable things. She's these not, you know, I want the glass windows from our house in England back, or I want actual butter with my bread, you know. And so this deeply flawed family, as all families are, but in this case, and they hold to this belief structure that requires them to be perfect, because you cannot earn salvation, but you can earn damnation, it seems. And so they have to be perfect. And when these cracks in their facade start to widen, they don't know how to deal with it. And that makes for this intense and terrifying reckoning with one another. So the second aspect is Thomason herself and the journey of this particular girl. Because from the beginning of the film, Thomason's the only one that is really distraught about being banished from the settlement. She's the only one who looks back. Everyone else is kind of looking to the side or looking forward. She's the one looking back at the settlement. And she's the only one that begins the movie with a prayer of forgiveness, prayer of confession. She's the only one that seems to understand and acknowledge her behavior as well as her thoughts and is accountable to him. Thomason is at this point, she's going through those changes of body that puberty have. But also she's going through those changes of mind, which we don't see, but kind of understand as adults. You know, the software is all being rewritten to go from child to adult. And so these mega doses of hormones that we understand outside the film that she's getting are just changing the way she understands the world around her. And she seems to find that world wanting. You know, she's got all this responsibility for all of the kids, the babies, the laundry, anything that happens seems to fall on her shoulders. And it seems that the only reason that is to keep her from being able to develop into a complete human being. It's like everything that happens, where's my silver cup? I didn't take it. I know you took it. I didn't take it. You know, and it takes a little bit too long before that kind of comes around. But there's also these hints throughout that maybe Thomason is, and we're getting an unreliable narrator. You know, she's there when the baby brother's gone. She's there when Caleb goes missing. She's the one who finds Caleb. She's there when he dies. She's there when the twins go missing, when the goats are slaughtered, when her father dies. She's the one that ultimately kills her mother in self-defense, but she does it. From the first third of the movie, you know, when she's being taunted about being a witch, you know, to the last third where her mother and father accuse her of being a witch, you know? And so Thomason as a character has this really long fall over the course of this thing, always proclaiming her innocence, and what it means to trust God. And yet everything is falling to pieces around her. Now, part of the myth of witches is that they're women with power. And so when the mom talks of Thomason, you know, showing signs of womanhood, we can almost hear her saying, oh, shit, this crazy bitch about to start having thoughts and upsetting the patriarchy. Better make sure it don't happen. You know, I mean, it's like if the Wayans brothers wrote this movie, that's what would have been said. Now, whether you believe Thomason's religious fervor or not, the reality is that she's steeped in it. And so we could almost view this movie as what happens when our personal houses of faith start being dismantled. Is there a framework that is strong enough to handle that. And in Thomason's case, that seems to be no. Because when it completely falls apart, when the last piece falls apart with her mother's death, it's no real surprise that she trades one set of religious experiences and expectations for another. You know, unlike the one she just left that contained nothing but restrictions, she goes out and Black Phillip promises her liberation. Now, I'll get it. So is the ending a happy one? I'm not convinced. I mean, it certainly seems like it looking at Thomason's face. She's embracing it. She's almost enraptured. But she's also signed her name in the devil's book, and my Judeo-Christian upbringing says that's bad. You know. however you cut it, though, this movie is well-made, well-shot, well-acted, and well-paced. It's slow, but it's well-paced. It is creepy as creepy gets, and the tone is oppressive to the nth degree. And it's worth watching. It's worth watching when the kids are abed, and I recommend it. Be like me on this one. Just cautiously.
Keep a light on in the living room.
Yeah, keep a light on. And, you know, you can't read during it, but maybe you could, you know, read Board Panda or maybe the Geek Cave podcast.
Maybe.
Maybe you could sign up.
The newly redesigned Geek Cave podcast.
Yes. Maybe you can put some video games in your queue from Gamefly.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Perhaps you could donate some money for Extra Life, which is coming up in like 4 months, and
yes,
be eligible for fabulous prizes.
Yes.
Because for some, the movie will be really, really intense and very anxiety producing. Because if you were to remove all the aspects of The Witch, which is a given, it's still a terrifying story of a family that's basically falling apart under stress.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I got to say. Be like me. Next month, I get to watch Bahubali, an Indian musical. The dice have spoken.
Nice.
So for Kent
Harris. From one extreme to the other, I see.
Yes, indeed. So for Kent Harris, a giant among men, Darren Wright, a man among men, Justin White, a dwarf among men, I'm Chad Savage, a hobbit among men. Thanks for listening, and remember, everyone's a geek for something. Oh, and Kyrie the Supercat's the one that killed Darren.